Tucker poses as a kind of highly curious journalist who is merely posing the questions other people are afraid to ask. Now, this is a little bit of a shtick because all his questions have built-in answers that are contained or concealed within the question. He has sources, usually dubious sources, disgraced academics, the nun with the mustache, and he drops these questions with a very quizzical look. He gets the expected answer that is already there in the question, and then he professes to be like thunderstruck by the answer and blown away by its insight and wisdom. Tucker and Candace are now part of a much bigger group. The bigger group includes people like Steve Bannon, Marjorie Taylor Greene. Megyn Kelly is leaning, it seems, to some degree in this direction. Now, all these people are somewhat different, and interestingly, I don't think that their motivation is the same. So what Satan does, he picks on the things that God seems to care about. Satan targets the Jews. If the Jews are the chosen people of God, Satan's view is, all right, well, I'll ruin them.
Okay, everyone, today we're joined by a really, really special guest, a legendary political commentator, author, and filmmaker, Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh, thank you so much for joining us across the pond. I know you were recently in Israel, and I'm looking forward to hearing a bit more about that soon. And by the way, I'd just like to say to our JTV audience, for those who might not be familiar with Dinesh yet, although I'm sure many of you are, I've covered a lot on this show about the rise of anti-Semitism, particularly in American discourse, and sadly on parts of the conservative right, to my surprise. And Dinesh has stood so firm on these issues. And so just really grateful to Dinesh for his moral courage and clarity in what is a rising stormy seas at the moment in that political scene. But Dinesh, first of all, thank you so much for being here with us today.
It's really a pleasure, and thank you for those kind words.
So before we dive into all those issues that I just mentioned, I just wanted to kind of zoom out for a second, just with everything that's been going on and that we've seen, particularly in the last 2 years that you've spoken about a lot since October 7th. I'm Jewish, you're Christian, but we both, I think, have this understanding that fundamentally Israel's battle and the anti-Semitism, the Western, anti-Western stuff, is a spiritual battle at its root. And for those who might be a bit skeptical of that, can you explain why you believe that is the case?
I think that when you are dealing with issues like October 7th or anti-Semitism, you can try to give a natural explanation, and that will get you so far, but only so far. So let's take anti-Semitism for a moment. In some of my earlier writings, I've tried to understand anti-Semitism in connection with, but also in contrast with, racism. So racism is a kind of looking down on somebody. Anti-Semitism is more complex because Jews are a very successful group, in fact, one of the most successful tribes in world history. So anti-Semitism is a kind of looking up. And I argued in some of my earlier writings that it's rooted in this very ancient human vice of envy. And that is indeed a partial explanation, but it hardly gives you a full grasp on anti-Semitism. In fact, I think some secular Jews have difficulty understanding it. They have this sort of, why do they pick on us? Why us? Why do they hate us? And I think here a supernatural explanation is necessary, not to displace, but to complement the natural explanation. We can get into that if you like. Similarly, October 7th. The remarkable thing about October 7th was that it was filmed by the perpetrators. And in this sense, one could say it takes on a special dimension of evil, but it also does it in a way that is very characteristic of true evil. The evil itself masquerades as good. And so you do something horrific, but then you are Allahu Akbar, look what I did, mom, I just killed 10 Jews, thanks be to God. So all of this, I think, demands, again, a certain type of reflection, really into human nature and into the nature of evil. Once you begin to grasp the nature of evil, you then begin to realize that there is, in fact, a great battle between good and evil that has been raging since the beginning of the universe. It's reflected in the things we see, but it transcends those things. And so this is sort of the intellectual basis for asserting that we should at least be open to the possibility of a spiritual war that is going on, that we are a part of, but that goes on also independent of us.
Absolutely, absolutely. And to be honest, I would like you to maybe go a bit deeper for our audience on that question of what drives anti-Semitism, because I agree with you that envy might be part of it, but you know, there were times in history when Jews were dirt poor, like in the Pale of Settlement in Russia, and yet they were also hated then. The pogroms occurred then, there were massacres there. So how does this go deeper? What's going on at a deeper level? Because I think many people are genuinely baffled by it, particularly my secular friends who just, they're like, what is this? What's going on? Even like radio presenters and TV presenters I was talking to last week who just are genuinely baffled by it. And I feel like, just as you say, naturalistic explanations don't satisfy anyone.
Let me try my hand at a supernatural explanation, one that is coming from a Christian perspective, but I don't think anything I'm about to say requires a kind of Christian underlying assumption. I think it's comprehensible in very general terms, and in fact, quite compatible with the Jewish and the Hebrew scriptures. So the idea here is that you've had an ancient grudge, if you will, between God and the devil. This is, by the way, the basis for my new film called The Dragon's Prophecy. The dragon is an allusion to the devil. So the devil in the book of Job is, of course, the Satan, the oppositional figure to God. And this opposition indicates kind of a long time opposition between good and evil going back to the very beginning. So now here's the point, that Satan or the devil is not strong enough to overthrow God. And so what Satan does, he picks on the things that God seems to care about. So why does Satan, for example, target Adam and Eve? What has Adam and Eve done to this to Satan? Nothing. But the reason that the serpent or Satan targets Adam and Eve is because they are God's cherished creation, mankind. And so Satan goes, if I can ruin them, I will get tremendous revenge, a great last laugh, if you will, on God. For the same reason, Satan targets the Jews. If the Jews are the chosen people of God, Satan's view is, all right, well, I'll ruin them. I'll run them out of their own ancestral homeland, quote, from the river to the sea. I will take their holiest site, the site of the Solomonic Temple. I will stick an Islamic victory arch on top of that called the Dome of the Rock, joined with the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And not only that, but I will pick on the people who claim to be descended from the Jews. In other words, the spiritual Israelites, the Christians. I'm going to turn up the temperature of persecution on them too. And by the way, not only in the Islamic world, but also in the sort of homeland of Christianity, which is the West. And so here you have a kind of theological or biblical hypothesis, but we can look around the world and say, is it a fact empirically that we are seeing a rising tide of hatred toward the Jews, a rising tide of hatred toward the Christians? And guess what? Isn't it coming from the same people? In other words, there is some empirical validation here for the kind of theological view that I just outlined a moment ago.
Absolutely fascinating. It's really fascinating. And to be honest, what I find striking is that you kind of see this so clearly, whereas it seems there are other people who may share similar, I don't know, ideological leanings to you or whatever that might not. And we'll get onto that in a second. It's interesting also that, you know, I think a lot of what you're saying very compatible from a Jewish theological standpoint. The Talmud itself says that in a sentence, Dennis Prager was famous for saying this line, that it says the Sina, which is Hebrew for the hatred of the nations towards Jews throughout history, comes from Sinai. It's like doing a play on words, Sinai, Sinai, because that's the moment, you know, God's mission for the world is communicated to the Jews. And so it's very much in opposition to that. So my question is, how is it that you see this so clearly? Or why is it that way? Because we're seeing at the moment simultaneously, and it came as a bit of a surprise to me, because I always associated the American conservative and Christian right to very much understand all these things that you're saying, particularly vis-a-vis the Jews and Israel. And I know there still is a great deal of support, particularly in the evangelical community. But could you help our audience understand why it is that we're starting to see a bit of a divergence now and a bit of a divide, and how to make sense of all of that?
Yeah, I think a good way to do that is to give as sympathetic as possible an explanation for the roots of this turn. It's not a good turn. I'm not sympathetic to it, but I'm going to try to give an account that helps us to make sense of it. The first thing is that there's been a shift from the, let's call it the Reaganite right, to the MAGA, or Make America Great Again right. And one element of that shift is a sense that America needs to focus on its own problems. In some cases, that is interpreted to mean go it alone, although there's nothing in MAGA itself that requires that, and Trump himself does not view it that way. It's very consistent to say, I believe in America first, but hey, we live in a dangerous world. We have allies, we have enemies. It makes sense to team up with our allies and clobber our enemies. But that is part of the intellectual soil that has shifted over my adult lifetime, more toward this kind of inward look. But now we get, I think, to more of the heart of the matter, which is that there are lots of young people who have become convinced that there is a group of elites in Western society. Many of them are in America. They're sometimes loosely called the deep state. But there are also a lot of globalist and international institutions. And these people have an agenda of their own that involves power and money and manipulating outcomes from food to health to the architecture of world politics. And the last people that they care about is the ordinary citizen. So unfortunately, the U.S. relationship with Israel has fallen into this way of thinking that this is, you know, here we go again. America, you know, cares about the World Health Organization. They care about Netanyahu. They care about Zelensky and Ukraine. The American, the ordinary, hardworking, blue-collar American is way down on this list. So here you begin to see why some people, particularly young people who don't have a good sense of history, who in fact have been lied to by a number of their institutions, from the Center for Disease Control, the NIH, the FBI, in fact, a lot of their professors, they've almost developed a psychology in which the more outlandish the conspiracy theory, the more likely it is to be true, because some conspiracy theories in the last few years have in fact proven correct. So this is just, I would say, some of the background that helps to understand why you find people gravitating to this kind of stuff.
That is really, really interesting. And I think it resonates a lot with what we're seeing on the ground. But doesn't it go a bit deeper as well? Because you could target many people and many causes when you have that kind of backdrop. And, you know, it seems to me like there are some people that are drawing on certain either theological interpretations or certain generalized views of Jews or Israel that's causing this. Like, does it not go a bit deeper, though? Certainly, and especially when it comes to the ringleaders.
No, for sure. I mean, I would put it this way. Because the term anti-Semitism, like racism, has now meets with the indignant rebuke, you know, just because I'm criticizing Israel, just because I don't like the Jews. And so what I say is, all right, here is my point. If you are applying to Israel and to the Jews a standard that you don't apply to anyone else, then your motives are rightly suspect. And I think that's what you're getting at here. You're getting at here is that, look, it's quite
about
obvious.
The obsession with AIPAC.
Well, AIPAC, but look at it more broadly. There is a clear alliance in the world between the cultural left in the West and these sort of global jihadis or radical Muslims on the other side. Some people call this loosely the Red-Green Alliance. Red signifying, you know, socialism or communism, and green, of course, the colors of Islam and of course, Islamic radicalism. Now, this is an unusual and unexpected alliance. Why? Because these two groups have completely different endpoints or goals. But even so, they are united. They're strange bedfellows. United in what? Well, I would say united in their hatred of Jews and Israel on the one side, and Christians and the principles of America and the West on the other. So it would seem natural. Nothing would be more obvious than that Christians and Jews should pull closer together. Israel and the United States should pull closer together in opposition to this threat. And this makes it all the more mystifying when you have prominent figures on the right, who, by the way, understand all this, but nevertheless are devoting their obsessive energies to driving a wedge between America and Israel, demonizing Netanyahu, demonizing the Jews, to the quite obvious benefit of the red-green alliance, which they profess to hate. So for this reason, I say your behavior is odd. I can understand why Ilhan Omar is the way she is, but I don't really understand why Tucker Carlson is the way he is. And yet Tucker Carlson and Ilhan Omar are pretty much on the same side when it comes to Israel.
So what's going on with Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens and others? What do you put their turn down to? Or maybe it's not a turn. Maybe that's how they always felt. But what's driving it?
First of all, there is a Tucker and Candace are now part of a much bigger group. The bigger group includes people like Steve Bannon, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a number of other prominent, you know, pundits. Megyn Kelly is leaning, it seems, to some degree in this direction. Now, all these people are somewhat different. And interestingly, I don't think that their motivation is the same. Mm-hmm. I know most of these people, well, almost all of them, and quite well in some cases. Last year, Tucker Carlson and I together did a 9-day tour in Australia, where we spoke in 6 or 7 major Australian cities. And so we were, you know, we were sitting in the green room together. We were having meals together. We were on the stage together. And so this whole thing is a little awkward for me. But I have to remind myself that my admiration for figures like Tucker and Candace developed in a completely different environment around completely different issues. In fact, Tucker made his reputation having nothing to do with Israel. The people who like Tucker like him for those reasons. And the same is true with Candace. She was like an outspoken, conservative Black woman who was taking on DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion. She was attacking Black Lives Matter. She was standing up, if you will, for the colorblind society, and she made a reputation on that basis. Now, my take on Candace is that she has always been someone who has wanted to be a cultural rather than a political figure. She wants to be like Oprah. She sees politics as a stepping stone to making this migration into the cultural sphere. For some reason, she got mixed up with and attached to Kanye West. She seems to have regarded him as a great trailblazer. And I don't know if the anti-Semitic element comes out of that association, because it is new for Candace. She never used to talk this way. So this is a turn in her thinking. Tucker, I think, is more complex and in some ways a little more dangerous, in part because Candace, you know, when she goes into this whole, you know, what people are jokingly calling the Candace Intelligence Agency, the CIA, where she's conducting her personal investigation, she's deputizing her followers to be sort of delegated FBI agents, she collects information from them. I mean, the whole thing has an element of parody to it. Reminds me like of the Pink Panther. But Tucker is a different animal because...
I'm so excited to share with you something that I've been working on for a while. We've just taken JTV content to the next level. Introducing JTV Plus, a new platform streaming exclusive content created and handpicked by me. Get ready for jaw-dropping documentaries, exclusive interviews, insider access, and so much more. JTV Plus brings you captivating stories that will shock and inspire you, stories that honestly, I'm discovering for the first time too. From Israel to Jewish history to Judaism, it's all there. In exclusive interviews, you'll hear guests open up about things they've never shared publicly before. Plus, I'll take you behind the scenes where I get a lot more personal with you. By joining JTV Plus, you're not just joining an exclusive community, you're partnering with me to help JTV reach new heights. Just search j-tv.plus and join our exclusive community today. There's a link in the video description. I'll see you there.
Tucker poses as a kind of highly curious journalist who is merely posing the questions other people are afraid to ask. Now, this is a little bit of a shtick because all his questions have built-in answers that are contained or concealed within the question. He has sources, usually dubious sources, disgraced academics, the nun with the mustache, and he drops these questions with a very quizzical look. He gets the expected answer that is already there in the question, and then he professes to be like thunderstruck by the answer and blown away by its insight and wisdom. And then he rubs his chin. That's very interesting, and so on. So I watched this again. I cannot take it entirely seriously. It's a little bit of a parody of genuine kind of the kind of questioning that, let's say, used to we'd get from Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. You know, there is a tradition in American journalism of probing questions aimed at eliciting genuine answers. Barbara Walters, for all her flaws, was good at this. She could bring out aspects of people's personality and of their ideas that they otherwise might be reluctant to spill the beans on. So Tucker is purporting to be in that tradition, but I think, unfortunately, toward a very nefarious end.
But we still haven't got to what do you think is the cause of motivating him to have all these lines.
All right, so here I go back to my theory that I have about three natural explanations and one supernatural one. And I offer these because I don't think, I'm not comfortable or confident that I have the answer. So the natural explanation all over social media, which I don't even have any idea if it's true, is Tucker is being paid by Qatar. Yeah. Now, I think on the other side of this, the thing that makes me a little skeptical of this being an adequate explanation, whether or not he's being paid by Qatar, is simply that Tucker Carlson comes from an affluent family. He has a huge following. He has a very easy ability to monetize that and make a lot of money on his own. He doesn't really need Qatar to pay his bills. So I think his full motivation requires an explanation that goes beyond that. Part of it could be that Tucker is just sort of one of these iconoclasts who likes to take the thing that people are most, the biggest taboos in society, and just go there. But even that, I think, falls short because your question again comes right back, which is, why is it always the Jews? Why does it always end up there? Why select this particular group? I mean, look, Christians are being massacred in Nigeria right now. If you're concerned about civilian casualties, go to a place where people are being intentionally massacred, right? There's a Christian just war tradition that goes back 1,000 years, and it's very clear that civilians die in wars. And so the death of civilians is not by itself an indication of horror or moral horror. The moral horror comes from the systematic intentional targeting of civilians, which, by the way, Hamas does, and which, by the way, the IDF does not do. Whatever the flaws of the IDF, they do not have a systematic intentional campaign of exterminating civilians. And Tucker really is smart enough to know that. When I was on Roseanne Barr's podcast, she reminded me that Tucker had made a sort of bizarre confession that he had been attacked by a demon. And I started laughing, and Roseanne goes, "Oh, no, Tucker says the demon actually scratched his face. He wasn't talking about a dream or some kind of, he was talking about a physical attack." And Roseanne Barr goes, "I think the demon got him." And she goes, "I know the name of the demon." And I'm like, "What is the name of the demon?" And she gave me a name that I don't really recall. It's something like Belok. She goes, "Oh yes, it's right there in the Hebrew scriptures. It's right there in the Talmud and in the other Jewish writings." And she goes, "Don't discount that, Dinesh, because that, I think, is part of the picture here." She says, "Tucker Carlson needs an exorcism." And so, look, again, I am a little bit better at being able to determine the effects of what these Pied Pipers are doing on the right. I'm a little bit less sure what their motives are.
Interesting. I mean, one of the things that I was so shocked by, and this can lead to a bit of a broader question about Christian relations with Israel, is that at Charlie Kirk's memorial service, I actually knew Charlie personally and was really deeply shocked by the, by what happened, that he spoke at the event and basically said that what happened to Charlie reminds him of what happened to Jesus, where some people in a dark lamplit room eating hummus planned to kill him. Now, first of all, the analogy doesn't work because it wasn't the powers that be killing him; it was a student that killed him. And secondly, it was so clearly trying to, I think, point the blame at the Jews. You know, he can try and play innocent and, oh, no, I didn't mean that. But come on. I mean, he knows how the game works and he had plausible deniability there. And the reason why I mention this is because is it not possible that it's two questions. Number one, is it possible that perhaps what's going on with Tucker is he's drawing on a very, sadly, there's a tradition in Europe of there's been a Christian hate persecution towards Jews due to certain theological views, which you don't really see so much in Christianity in America, thank God. Could that be what's going on there with him? And so and that would lead to my second question, which is how does your Christian faith in not lead you to have that kind of relationship with Jews and Israel that sometimes has been there in history?
Now, this is a case
I've thrown a lot at you, by the way.
No. And this is, in fact, a profound question that engages theology and of course, history. This is a topic I have thought about a lot. I've written three books on Christian apologetics. About a decade ago, I did a number of debates with leading atheists around the world, people like Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins. So this is a territory I actually know a lot better than someone like Tucker. Now, the debate as it's framed in the United States today is between sort of two strands of esoteric theology. One is called dispensationalism, which is a reading within Protestantism of the end times. Like, it is an attempt to decipher from the book of Revelation that this will happen and this will happen and this will happen after that. This is the dispensational unfolding. The other esoteric idea is called replacement theology. And the simple idea here is that the New Testament or the Christian scriptures replace the Jewish scriptures and in a sense make them obsolete. I think that this is a false dichotomy because there is in fact a mainstream Christian tradition going back 2,000 years. Now, like all traditions, it evolves, but it evolves around a kind of mainline path. And the mainline path was established very early in the Christian scriptures, something called the Acts of the Apostles, where the Apostle Paul, who is the apostle to the Gentiles, to the non-Jews, is bringing all these non-Jews become followers of Jesus. And Jesus's actual apostles are annoyed because they say, you can't do this. Jesus was a Jew, and anybody who wants to follow Jesus needs to become a Jew first and then follow Jesus, because Jesus is coming out of the Jewish root. And so you need to adopt that root first, and only then can you consider yourself a Christian. Think of it. This was the view of all the 11 apostles, 11, of course, minus Judas. So there's a meeting between Paul and the apostles to hash it out. And they do hash it out, and they come out with a very simple answer. And that is that these new Christians, the Gentiles, do not in fact have to be circumcised, or they do not have to keep the Sabbath, and they don't have to follow some of the Jewish rituals. But guess what? They have to take everything else. They have to adopt the Genesis account of creation. They have to adopt the Exodus. They have to adopt the Ten Commandments. They have to adopt the Psalms. They have to adopt the teaching of the prophets. All of it is incorporated into Christianity. And this is the reason, by the way, why, if you look at the Christian Bible, the first half of it, in fact, the longer part, is in fact the Hebrew scriptures, and then the shorter part is the New Testament. So you can see right here that the mainstream of Christianity was built on an incorporation and not an abrogation, right? In Islam, there's a doctrine of abrogation where the later verses cancel out the earlier verses. There's no such doctrine in Christianity. So I think what I'm getting at here as somebody who not only cares about conservatism, but cares about Christianity, is that this whole idea of replacement theology, I think, is really an abomination. It's an abomination to the mainstream understanding of Christianity. I agree, through the centuries, there are people who have adopted this kind of rhetoric, basically to try to create an anti-Jewish Christianity. And it does seem like these new Pied Pipers are drawing on those threads. But I want to emphasize that the mainstream of Christianity is represented by, I think it was Pope John Paul II, who visited Israel, and he made this statement. He said, "It is the Holy Land for everybody, but it is the Promised Land only to the Jews." And this is, again, this is not Protestant dispensationalism coming from the Pope. This is the mainstream understanding of Christianity, Catholic and Protestant both.
And that presumably for you is what grounds you and your faith in support for Israel and the Jewish people.
Well, my support is built on three pillars or three layers. You just mentioned the theological level. That's one of them. The second one, I would call it the cultural or moral level. And that is just a simple understanding that Western civilization and what is best about it, what makes it a civilization that I, as a guy who grows up in India, would want to emigrate to and become a part of. Western civilization, the philosopher Leo Strauss says, is built on the twin foundations of Athens and Jerusalem. Athens is a little more obvious. It's Socrates, it's free speech. It is the Greek theater, it is Pericles and the idea of democracy. It is ultimately, I think, the roots of modern science. But people forget what Jerusalem is all about. Jerusalem is about Jefferson's assertion that our rights come from our Creator. Jerusalem is about a moral code in the universe that exists independent of us, that make claims on us. The Ten Commandments is a good stand-in for that code. I don't think that our civilization would have its dynamism and strength without both Athens and Jerusalem. You can't kick out one pillar and have the edifice still standing. So that's the second reason I want to protect Athens and Jerusalem both. And the third reason is more political. It's realpolitik. It's more strategic. It's simply based on the idea that Israel is on the front lines of fighting radical Islam. Israel is really good at it. Why? I think in part because Israel lives in a really bad neighborhood, and people who live in a bad neighborhood develop a real situational awareness. They're always looking over their shoulder. They're closer to survival, and therefore they've got a sort of cannier understanding of situation on the ground. America is looking at radical Islam in some ways from a long distance away, at least prior to attempts to infiltrate America by radical Islam itself, which is ongoing. But America's record in dealing with radical Islam, from pulling the rug out from the Shah of Iran and helping us get Khomeini, from clobbering the Taliban, but then the Taliban comes back, from the war in Iraq, the American record is checkered or mixed at best. And so I say, hey, when Israel is doing such a fantastic job of fighting terrorism, by the way, not just in the West Bank and Gaza, but in Sudan and Yemen and Qatar and Iran, there's an overwhelming strategic argument for the United States backing and being allied with Israel. So I see these as three independent arguments for supporting Israel. Each of them would stand in some senses on its own, but put together, it makes a strong case.
Absolutely, absolutely. So well said. Dinesh, just in the last bonus section, I just want to touch on a couple of current affairs issues with regard to the Israel-Hamas ceasefire that we've seen. I wanted your thoughts on Trump's ceasefire deal, because the two big concerns that I've been articulating since this happened is, well, it's essentially all wrapped into one thing, which is I'm worried we're going back to square one. We're going back to the same mistakes of Israel withdrawing from parts of Gaza, creating a vacuum, having Arab autonomy, and even if other Arab countries get involved in running that, that could even be worse. And then on top of that, releasing all these terrorists back into Gaza. What are your thoughts on the deal? In the next bonus section, I asked Dinesh his thoughts on Trump's ceasefire deal, the dangers of Qatar, how Dinesh sees the future for Israel in the region, but also Israel's increasingly tense relationship with the West, how Dinesh thinks Israel needs to be even tougher on its enemies, and Dinesh's most striking memory from his recent visit to Israel. To join us for this part of the conversation, as well as access a whole new range of JTV Plus premium content, just click on the link below in the video description. I'll see you there.